Energy Transition, episode number 51. Our topic today is Evolution of Climate Alarmism, part 2. Good morning, David Blackmon, Irina Slav, and Timmy Nimet. Good afternoon.
Morning.
Morning.
Exceptionally, this episode is not being live. It was previously recorded. Comments can be made on David's LinkedIn post, if he allows. Irina, going back to the last point of last week, in your view, is there a connection between climate alarmism and a world with more control, a kind of state control?
Well, definitely. Because as we can all see, the energy transition is being driven by environmentalist organizations and governments. And governments are subsidizing the transition, governments are setting the agenda, governments are telling industries what to do. Today I read something really interesting, a series of comments on the 2035 internal combustion engine car ban that the European Parliament voted this week. And you know, from the Italian industry, car industry, car supplies industry. And these executives were saying that it's the wrong thing to do because it's not starting this transition from petrol cars to electric vehicles. It is not starting from the industry, it's starting from government.
Right.
And people in government have not worked a day in the car industry. So we already have governments taking away the power of so-called free markets. I don't believe to date we actually have free markets. And a big part of why we don't have free markets is this push for the energy transition, in which climate organizations, nonprofits, and governments work together to tell everyone how to live. Now, you'd say this is a wild extrapolation, but it's not, if you think about it. They're talking about EVs. They're talking about 15-minute cities. They are implementing 15-minute cities. And to me, this is direct interference in people's life choices, where to live, and how to move around. All these subsidies that I mentioned, again, it's a way to centralize power over everything, over the economy. We're subsidizing wind and solar. We're not subsidizing oil and gas because they're bad. So investors follow the flow of subsidies because they think they will make more money if they get on board with what governments support, because governments have the power and they're getting too much power, I believe. And when governments get too much power, it's not good for anybody except for those in government. And that's David, totalitarianism.
Yeah, totalitarianism. Yes. David, this was what Elon Musk said today or yesterday, and you post something related to that.
Right, yeah. Earlier this week at the World Government Conference in Dubai, Elon Musk actually warned of this very dynamic that's happening with governments trying to force companies to behave as they want them to behave. And he warned against too much cooperation among governments and used the fall of Rome as a prime example. You know, the collapse of ancient Rome occurred at the same time there was a renaissance happening in the Islamic world. And the development of the Muslim world really kept the engine of learning and human creation going, as Roman society, which had been the dominant society on earth, was collapsing. And had everyone been, you know, going along singing from the same playbook, singing, that's a mixed metaphor there, proceeding along the same playbook, you know, global society could have collapsed. And the same thing could happen if governments all take what the World Economic Forum wants them to do, and all proceed down this same path, you know, with the motivating dynamic is climate change, you know, that they're using to try to implement world socialism, which is essentially what's happening here. And Klaus Schwab spoke at the same conference and, you know, said exactly the opposite of what Musk said, as we would expect Klaus Schwab to do. And so, you know, I like my great uncle was a very wise man. And 30 years ago, he warned me that we were moving into an era of what he called corporate socialism. When you look at the attendees at the annual WEF conference, it's not just government people. It's also corporate leaders from all over the world, all buying into this same movement to global socialism, you know, using climate change as the rationale. They also use COVID-19 pandemic as a kickoff point for what the WEF likes to call the Great Reset, right? And that really increased the pace of authoritarian growth around the world in places like New Zealand and Canada and Europe and the United States, made a massive move in the direction of authoritarian socialism using COVID-19 as the rationale. And they're continuing that with climate change now. And so it's a very dangerous time here for all of us right now.
And Tammy, you are in the UK, and how do you see the countries, the UK and Canada, you know very much because you are from Canada, the US, Bulgaria, and Brazil, in terms of more to the left or the right direction and this kind of control?
That's a good question. Like it's funny because when we first moved to Europe from Canada, we were thinking about how there really isn't true conservatism in Europe. And in the UK, there's a conservative party, but they really aren't. They're like Labour light now. And especially yeah. Once David Cameron came in and took everything really to the left. And when they talk about a spectrum, it's moved so far left that anybody who isn't a full-blown socialist is considered extreme right wing. Because right. When we were living in Holland, Geert Wilders was starting and there was a bunch of other things going on in Holland. And so we looked at what his platform actually was. And we were thinking, my gosh, that's pretty left wing. The only thing he disagrees with them on is immigration. So we realized that it was turning into this us versus them. And the them is anybody who disagrees with the agenda. And you see that in Canada's gone very much left. The Liberal Party used to be the party of business, kind of like the Conservatives as well. And they've allied themselves with the New Democrat Party, which is declared socialist. So, and the reason why the NDP didn't do so well was because the Liberals had taken so much of their platform. And it was like, well, okay, what's the difference here? And so the little conservative party that's left in Canada is, you know, primarily their support is in the West, in Saskatchewan and Alberta, parts of Manitoba, certain places in the interior of British Columbia, where there's more blue collar workers and parts of rural Ontario. And it's becoming very much a rural urban split where you have the urban very much supporting all of this environmental stuff because I hate to say it, but many people in the city do service work, you know, whether it's financial services, that kind of thing, where they actually are divorced now from actual work and how things operate. And a lot of this environmental stuff affects those jobs and that industry that makes stuff. So if you're targeting that and you're going to change people's way of life, the people in the cities are like, well, that's great if there's a supermarket down the street and then I don't have to take an Uber or I can walk or something that suits them, but it's not necessarily better for the planet. And it brings us to the aspect of the transition. And when I was talking with Francis Menton a few months ago, he's like, well, if they're so sure that this is better and it's going to work, give us a test site. Take a city of 45,000 people or whatever and go full renewable, do all of this and see what happens. And every little test case that they've tried has failed spectacularly. And they've been small test cases. Like there's the island, I think in the Maldives or something, where they had hydro storage and so on. And it was a disaster. They still had to use their diesel generators in order to have power. Yeah. And the only time it's successful is when it's like 300 people and they have 100 windmills to power 300 people, which tells you then that renewables is really a niche market. It's great for small things, but to power a modern technological society, it just doesn't work. Show us the goods. Show us it works before you go and redo the entire global economy.
Wow, that's great. Let me change for another point, Tammy, using the same thoughts. The energy transition appears to provoke the way people live. Do people understand the gains and losses, the impacts that they can experience with energy transition? I mean, the alternatives are clear for people, general people?
No, not at all. And honestly, the leaders who are pushing this have been very disingenuous to the people. And I don't want to say lying because that's bad, but they've been disingenuous. And you can interpret that as you will. But so they say you can have a car, it'll just be electric. And you can still keep your way of life. It'll just be powered by renewables, which is so awesome. And then it starts to morph into, well, maybe you can't have the EV. We don't have enough power. Well, maybe you can't keep your way of life because there isn't enough power or it's unreliable and you're going to have to ration and you're going to have to change how you're living and everything. So on the one hand, they're saying you can keep everything. We're just going to swap stuff out. And they're not being honest, not having an honest conversation about what that actually means in practice. And it was Eric Heyman from Deutsche Bank, who I think it was in the fall of 2020, made the argument that the EU and all the Western countries need to have an honest conversation about what the energy transition means for people, that your life is going to change. You're not going to be able to eat the food you want. You're not going to be able to travel where you want, when you want. And they need to be honest. And I don't think the leaders have been honest.
Interesting.
And would they dare?
Would they
no,
dare?
They wouldn't.
They dare be honest.
Because people would they would reject it, right?
Yeah.
Even if they try, I'm thinking now, if they try to serve it, portion by portion in small portions, that might have worked, but it would have taken a very long time. But they're trying, for example, was it Cambridge University or Oxford University that banned lamb or beef? Was it? They banned some, either beef or lamb because of the emissions footprint. And they were hailing it as this massive victory. But that's enforced. I mean, if people could choose, they wouldn't choose to not eat meat. So they have to be forced. They have to be indoctrinated, which is exactly what is happening. All these huge emissions of beef and lamb and all, actually, animal husbandry. We should all eat plants because it's so much better. And governments are backing this, and they keep repeating the same stuff, that wind and solar are cheaper. They are out of ideas because they cannot have any new ideas. They can only find new ways to spread their message. And because there are a few of these, I imagine, we keep hearing the same thing over and over again, and we will give more money, even more money, for wind and solar, and we will allow insects, more insects, into our food. I have no idea why.
Yeah.
Except, no, seriously, if it's extra nutritious, okay, but I didn't read anything about it being more nutritious. It's treated as novel food, like exotic fruit from South America, for example. So are we just being diversify to something, or are we preparing for a time when it would be cheaper to farm insects, poor things, instead of growing wheat and other crops, because there will not be enough energy, because we are expanding in Europe, we are expanding biofuels production, which requires land, and it means displacing other agricultural, you know, produce. So it's really intricate web of manipulation, I think.
Well, that is a very good way to describe it. Yeah,
it is. It is. And what I can't wait for is when we all go to eating insects instead of beef, the rise of the insect extinction rebellion movement.
How dare you?
Right.
I will block
traffic to protect the rights of cockroaches.
I will be the first to sign up for this, because insects are essential.
Yes, they
are. For the functioning of our ecosystems.
Exactly.
Do we have the right to farm them and kill them? Yeah.
Right. I understand. So honeybees are very tasty, I'm told, if you fry them up in grease. And so, you know, I mean, but should we be eating honeybees? They're actually essential to agriculture.
Yeah.
I don't think we ought to be eating honeybees, right? Or ants, or, you know, all these insects that.
Mealworms and whatnot.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah,
well, it was funny because it's one of the contradictions of the movement, because on the one hand, they were saying, oh, my gosh, there's an insect apocalypse and agriculture is going to die in Europe. And this is really bad. Oh, but wait, we want you to eat lots of insects. Well, right. Wait a second. I thought there was an apocalypse. What's going on here?
Right. Eat them before they're gone, folks. You know,
before they're gone.
It's a different kind of insect.
Yeah. Artificial insect.
Yeah, they're harvested. Do they have feelings? I don't know.
If lobsters do, all a lobster is a seaborne insect, right? I mean, that's what crustaceans really are. They're little different than airborne insects. And if a lobster has feelings.
I don't like this
analogy. But Irina, what kind of organization can exist to control and determine this world trend? Because I cannot understand how they meet, how they decide, who are they?
I don't know. What they, the European Union, you have the European Union. It's a pan-governmental organization. It's a super government for the whole of Europe. I mean, they like to remind us that each member state has sovereignty. It has the right to say what it wants to do with the funds that the EU distributes, but only if what it wants to do falls under step 1, 2, or 3. So there's the illusion of sovereignty. How they meet and how they communicate, I have no idea. I mean, you have the EU, you have the Biden administration, they're all on the same page. They all want to bring the world to net zero, or at least their respective countries and groupings of countries.
Yeah, you know, didn't Elon Musk actually...
It's out in the open.
It is out in the open. And Elon Musk, in a tweet a couple of months ago, pointed out that the World Economic Forum has lately come to function as a de facto unelected world government. And that's very dangerous. And so a lot of these decisions are made at WEF conferences and the COP conferences sponsored by the UN. And it's why you see all these global leaders and elites who are pushing all this fly their private jets out to these cities, wherever the conference is held, and spend a week out there making all these decisions for the rest of us.
And eating meat.
And eating a lot of meat, yes.
That's a good one. David, please, there is a point that calls my attention. I know that we talked before, several weeks ago, but it's so significant for me. The oil and gas industry always blame it for climate issues.
Mm-hmm.
In the past, oil industry had a good relationship with the media, I suppose. Nowadays, it looks bad.
No.
No, exactly.
Not in America. Ida Tarbell. I mean, oh my gosh.
Well, I mean, in Brazil, it may have. It may well have in Brazil, but in the United States, no. No. Yeah, not since Ida Tarbell and John D. Rockefeller, right? 120 years ago. But yes, the oil industry does get blamed. There is no question, by the way, I'm not a climate denier, a science denier. There's no question that carbon emissions from the oil and gas industry have contributed, no doubt, to the rise in the carbon dioxide content in the atmosphere. That is a settled, that if you say the science is settled, that aspect of it is settled. There's no question. ExxonMobil does not dispute that. The question is, what's the answer? What's the right approach to dealing with it? And so, you know, and I think that's where we end up getting declared climate deniers, because personally, I don't believe, and I think it's a lot of people don't believe, that the laws of physics and thermodynamics can be repealed and allow wind and solar power to replace fossil fuels and nuclear power in our energy mix. It just can't happen. It physically cannot happen. It's an impossibility. And when I look at it, I see that the human race has always been incredibly good and smart and innovative in mitigating for a changing climate, the impacts of a changing climate. And even if you believe the IPCC's most wild scenarios, we're looking at a rise in global temperatures of about 2 degrees Celsius in the next 80 years. And even the IPCC says the most significant impact of that is going to be slightly higher sea levels, some melting ice, and displacement of some populations along certain coastlines, and perhaps a 4% reduction in global economic growth. Okay. These are not overwhelming impacts for the human race to be able to mitigate for. And so when I look at it, I believe if we're going to spend trillions of dollars, we ought to be spending trillions of dollars cleaning up the energy system we have, which we know works and has worked incredibly well and efficiently, and mitigating for slightly higher sea levels and these other potential impacts. And so it just, it's, you know, the debate gets all tied up in name calling, and that's because, back to the point you made earlier, that politicians have to deflect and mislead in order to get reelected next time. They can't talk honestly about any of this. Al Gore can't talk honestly about any of this, which is why 20 years ago he declared the science to be settled, and he would in 20 years has never been agreed to have any kind of a debate with anyone on this. So it's all very dishonest and misleading, and we're focused on the wrong solutions here, folks. We really are.
But that goes to what Irina was saying about this, the corporate is involved with the governments to kind of shift the world and the Western countries in particular to a certain form of government, or at least ruling over people. And you call it corporate socialism. I would call it corporatism, which has its roots in fascism and so on. Yeah. And I think the problem is that people don't understand what a lot of these terms mean. And there's a lot of multiplicity in terms being employed. So people are like, well, is it socialism? Is it communism? Is it state communism? Is it state socialism? So on and so forth. But in the end, it's government telling, colluding with corporations to tell people how to live.
Right.
And that's not something that's good, because it's not even just how you live, but what our energy system will be, how the industries will operate and everything. And that's just a recipe for disaster.
And it's a recipe for... Go ahead, Emma.
That's why I call it totalitarianism. I mean, there's nothing unclear about totalitarian rule.
And it creates bad incentives. It creates, in free societies that are currently free in Europe and the West, in democratic societies, it creates perverse incentives, because if you're constantly going back and forth between conservative governments and liberal governments, you can't engage in the long-term planning and policy direction, consistent policy direction to subsidize a 25-year transition into being. And so the incentive that creates is to fix and rig and steal elections on the left so that you can have a long-term planning implementation not interrupted by inconvenient things like a re-election of a Donald Trump or the election of a Republican in 2024 or 2028. And it creates terrible incentives in the maintenance of a free and fair system of elections. And the United States is not the only place where that perverse incentive has been happening in recent years.
Well, it's not even just about the elected officials. I think they've been very good at infiltrating the bureaucracy, as Donald Trump found out. I mean, he was elected, but there was only so much he could do because there was resistance by the bureaucracy dragging their feet, couldn't get things done. And then there's litigation, and then they're negotiating right with the environmental groups to litigate and so on. So it's pervasive throughout all different elements of our Western society, in academics, in corporate life, in the bureaucracy. So it's very difficult at this juncture to resist. But I think people still could if they understood and knew right what was happening.
And that's the perverse incentive for not telling the truth and properly educating people about what's really happening.
That's right. Irina, please bring to us some thoughts about this last article you published today.
That was about freedom of speech, which has a lot to do with the energy transition. It's one of its victims. And I wrote it after I read a report compiled by a couple of veteran journalists, I think editors in major media, how we should move beyond facts in order to be trustworthy and more truthful. And from what I understood, facts and objectivity are a remnant of an old age when white male editors set the rules. And apparently anything that white males did in the past is wrong and should be thrown out. And this includes objectivity. And objectivity, to me, and I guess to most people, is an approach to reporting that holds back emotions, holds back opinions, as much as this is possible, because we're all biased. We let our biases through in one way or another, which is what editors are for, but let me not digress. So the idea of objective reporting was to state the facts as they happened, and that's it, and reserve judgment, leave it to readers. This is, of course, no longer the case. It cannot be the case because there's so much competition with social media. It's not a coincidence they're called social media. Everybody can be a reporter now. And many people are, even if they've never been trained journalistically, which is, I think, an advantage for them. So the large corporate media are basically, I think, competing for the attention of the audiences. And the best way to engage audiences is with emotional language. It doesn't have to be factual. It doesn't have to be objective. The less objective and the less factual reporting is, the more people will read what you've written because you're appealing to their emotions. It's all about clickbaiting, really.
True.
Great.
But they're trying to finish. They're trying to institutionalize it with these prescriptions. We should unite reporting with opinion statement.
Right, exactly. And it's so instructive that the authors of that story you referenced, one is a former executive editor at the Washington Post.
Right.
Okay? Yeah. These are editors themselves advocating for this. By the way, that former editor at the Washington Post is himself a white male.
He's of the good variety, I'm sure.
I'm sure.
He's probably identified as privileged, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah.
And
he avoids objectivity and facts. And so I'm sure he was a great editor for the Washington Post, you know, given his bias, his own personal bias.
Yeah.
But that's what's happening in our media here in the United States and really across the free world, is this abandonment of objectivity and focus on facts. And, you know, it's a dangerous dynamic in any free society to lose objectivity in the press.
Almost. Do you find that's happening for you at Forbes, though? I mean, are they going pathway?
No, and in fact, the current editor staff has allowed me great freedom to write what I write, and as long as I write about energy. I mean, you know, I'm there to write about energy. I'm not there to write about politics. You know, anything else. And as long as I stay in that lane, they've given me great flexibility and freedom. Previously, a few years ago, there was I probably shouldn't even talk about that. But yeah, okay. It's been good.
Fantastic. This conversation today was great, fantastic. This the part two of alarmism is fantastic. It didn't tell me how many vacations do you take per year?
Irina?
I take one week in the middle of the year and whatever Christmas holidays we have.
Yeah, you tell me.
You know, as somebody who does a lot of research and stuff, I feel like I never have a vacation, because even when I'm on vacation, I'm reading and I'm trying to understand what's going on and stuff. And my husband gets mad at me. He's like, "Would you stop reading?" I'm like, "Oh, no, I can't."
I'm vacation. And you, David?
It's the same way for me on my 8 vacations every year. I'm really not off, folks. I still read and research and write while I'm on vacation, as I will be this coming week. So hope everyone enjoys.
You just change the scenery a bit.
Yeah, exactly. We figure we better get our travel in, my wife and I, before Klaus Schwab eliminates it and makes it impossible to do.
Excellent. Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to meet you today. Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
Always everyone great.
Thank you, Armando. Week. Thank you, David. Thank you, Irina.
Have a great week.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Have a great week. Bye.
Bye.